Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. Kathleen Sadat was raised in a family committed to justice and education and learned early on that she had a responsibility to put her efforts into making things better. The equal rights activist was in Astoria last month for events marking the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. She spoke at Clatsop Community College and at an evening meeting for the Lower Columbia Diversity Project. Sadat has long worked to further equality for all, regardless of race, gender, or sexual orientation. She served as Oregon's Director of Affirmative Action from 1987 to 1990, and recently retired as Portland's Diversity Development and Affirmative Action Manager. What follows is a highly condensed version of her talk to the diversity group. Recording conditions were not ideal, and some parts may be more difficult to hear. But we thought what she had to say outweighed the poor quality of the recording. So here is Kathleen Sadat speaking about equality, Dr. King, and keeping the dream alive.
First, I want to tell you a little bit about why I do what I do. I do training. I do public speaking. I do conflict resolution. I work with small agencies usually, help them improve their workforce in terms of their sensitivity to and their ability to work together across the artificial divisions we have placed between ourselves. I do this because I believe in America. I do this because I believe in Americans. I do it because I believe that we can together something different, something that hasn't been done before. Before America happened, America hadn't been done before. So it's not just wishful thinking. I've seen a lot of good things in the world, and they reinforce my belief that we can do good things in this world. It won't happen overnight, but they can happen. Dreams I have about living in this country were instilled in me by my family in the 1940s. Family who survived slavery, who survived poverty and despair. My grandparents had seven children. The first one was born in 1901. Of those seven children, four of them finished college. They taught me to believe in my own potential, the potential of other black people, and the potential of this country. So they handed me that. From them, I learned about equality and justice. And perhaps because we found ourselves living in segregated communities, we understood that we all had value. Doctors, lawyers, and in, it's more so here in Oregon, but in a place like St. Louis, which was had a large black population, lots of doctors, lots of lawyers, lots of teachers, all there, all present, all visible within that community, along with the janitors and the domestics, or we call them day workers. And yes, some people had more money than others. But the rule I was raised with is if you have more, your obligation is to give back. We went to the same churches. We pooled money in those churches to send people to college. That was the community I was raised in. And it's as close as I can think about to the idea of the beloved community. What I also learned from them was that I had a responsibility and obligation to put my efforts into making things better. Before there were marches in Selma, I had two aunts who were teachers. And in Missouri at the time, if you got married, woman, you were supposed to give up your teaching job. They protested it. They made noise about it. They also joined with other people to sit in restaurants periodically. Nothing like the movement of the 60s, but enough to get thrown out, talked to poorly. It was their passion for a better world that I adopted. We can do this, we can do this. Their dreams became mine, and those dreams continue to drive me, to influence me, to guide me. It was from Dr. King that I learned to better articulate the dream of the beloved community. What it means, what can mean. And for him, it was not this fantasy in the sky, we're all going to get together and we're all going to be happy, and it sort of sounds like heaven and milk and honey. But he believed that a group of people trained in nonviolent techniques to come to make a difference in the world and make a more loving world, one in which people actually shared the wealth of the planet. He did not think that there would be no conflict. He thought that we could resolve conflict without war. That is what he believed. His vision was of a global community in which everyone shared in the wealth of the earth. He envisioned a community where hunger, poverty, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. He imagined the philosophies of sisterhood and brotherhood as the underpinnings for that community. Eliminating racism and all other forms of discrimination would depend upon that idea of us being brothers and sisters on this planet, sharing things here. The conflict resolution skills that he saw were not just to resolve the conflict. They were also restorative in that he wanted to see reconciliation between the people who had conflict. Dr. King's beloved community recognized that conflict was inevitable, but believed that conflicts could be resolved peacefully. And I believe that too. He referred to triple evils. One was poverty. There's nothing new about poverty. This is what he said. What is new, however, is that we now have the resources to get rid of it. The time has come for an all-out world war against poverty. The well-off and the secure have too often become indifferent and oblivious to the poverty and deprivation in their midst. Note that Dr. King did not say black poverty, or white poverty, or Asian poverty, or short people's poverty. He just said poverty. And poverty is not just an absence of money. It cannot make me fit into this society if I'm really, really poor, and especially if it's intergenerational poverty, and you just can't hand me money and expect me to be like you. Number one, I may not want to be. But even if I wanted to be, that does not solve the problem. There's a lot more that has to happen. Yes, money is needed. I need to be warm and dry. I need to be fed. He linked poverty to homelessness, hunger, malnutrition, illiteracy, infant mortality, poor living conditions, and said, ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. No individual or nation can be great if it does not have a concern for the least of these. And here is one of my big anger points. I do not believe that anybody who has served in the armed services should have poverty linked to their name, homelessness linked to the country. Right now, we have veterans sleeping on the street, young people that we sent somewhere to be injured, come back to us, and we ignore them. He said racism is a philosophy. The second evil was racism. And he said it saw it as a philosophy based on contempt for life, an arrogant assertion that one race is the center of value and should be the object of devotion, for which other races must kneel in submission. He says it's a total estrangement. It separates us not only in our bodies, but in our spirits. We know that racism and other forms of bias and bigotry are present in our communities. Also come to understand that we are so indoctrinated with these biases, they often work themselves out without our even knowing that that's what's happening. There's a website, Implicit Bias. I think if you Google that, you'll find a place to go take a test where you'll find out how biased you are. Surprise.
It's called Project Implicit.
Okay.
Project Implicit. It's a website, yes, and it's...
It's interesting.
Yes.
It's interesting. And I encourage people, I've done it once, I've encouraged people to do it because you need to know who you are. And I don't think there's any guilt or shame to associate with understanding that you have been indoctrinated from the day you were born with biases and bigotry. Got born and slapped you on the butt and you said, white, male, aha, he goes over here. Black, female, she goes over there. Latina, she goes here. Those things are put, they are given to you. Your first meal, your first milk, they are given to you. You have no power to resist them because you don't even know they're there. And they're subtle. About militarism, he said, war, imperialism, domestic violence, rape, terrorism, human trafficking, media violence, drugs, child abuse, violent crime. We can have a true revolution of values, which would lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This way of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of people normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped, psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. I say again, there is no reason that can explain the callous nature of the phenomenon of a veteran without resources to help make him or her whole. Dr. King talked about changing those triple evils, and I believe that it's to our benefit as human beings to move in that direction. Now, some people, oh, you're just dreaming. Well, okay, maybe I'm just dreaming. That's what we're talking about. We have a dream. We can choose to go in a particular direction. If we don't, we're guaranteed a certain set of problems. We have nothing to lose by going toward that which is positive. So cynics, stay home. Every day we get information overload. Badness of war, terrorism, threat to feelings of security, racial strife, hungry children. Time we did something other than go, oh my God, what are they doing? I have to decide to be involved. If I want to see my dream approach reality, I must involve myself in the design and building of that dream. That also means that because I'm not always a peaceful person, for Kathleen, I must also look to see how I can design myself better to fit into that dream that I hold of a peaceful world. Maya Angelou said, one isn't necessarily born with courage, but one is born with potential. Without courage, we cannot practice any other virtue with the consistency. We can't be kind, true, merciful, generous, or honest. If we hold on to courage, it enables us to do so many other things. Many of us grew up believing that because we say we are someone or something, we are that. We believe without examination that we did the right thing in terms of acting out our beliefs and values. As we grow older, and this is my experience anyway, and make mistakes, sometimes the same ones over and over and over again, we start to figure it out. We come to understand that we're not always acting as the people we say we are. And our friends and our family will often help us understand that very well. Okay. If we're fortunate, we'll learn to watch ourselves behave, and we will be honest with ourselves about our feelings and behaviors. Then we can have honest conversations. If we don't have the honest conversation, if the problem is A and we're talking about B, we are not working on the problem. We didn't invent bias and bigotry, but we got it. It's in us. We're raised in the context of the United States of America, not given many options for belief in a different world, better world for many people was having. Many, we've been discouraged from thinking about peaceful coexistence because of lines drawn. Race, religion, gender, age, draw the line, get in the box. It's a scary subject. A lot of us are afraid we'll do something wrong, or we won't do it right. And we're afraid of what others will think if we take a stand. We're afraid that we won't maybe ostracize, nobody will understand. Again, the fear can be a block to progress, not just for the community, but for yourself. Sometimes if you stand up, you'll find somebody else will say, yeah, me too. You know, I was thinking that, I just didn't know how to say it, or I didn't want to say it. But now I've got somebody else saying it, and maybe there's a couple more people that at least will think about what you said. If you know who you are, goals and your intentions are clear. You'll understand why you respond the way that you do. And that honesty will allow you to be able to manage yourself. we get to embrace all of ourselves. Empathy, compassion, additional tools that we need in order to make change. Without them, there is no foundation for working to understand the life or lives of those who live differently from ourselves. So you don't have to have black skin or brown skin or speak another language. And how painful these, because in your life you have had pain. If you choose to empathize with me and extend compassion, then we can start a dialogue about how to get rid of the pain. Another important piece, and I talked about this earlier today, is forgiveness. Forgiveness is a necessary component of a beloved community, a necessary component of a human relationship of any kind. You cannot have a friendship, a marriage, with whom you form family if you are not willing to forgive on some level. It doesn't work. I question whether we can stay together as a country and nation if we will not forgive one another. But I don't think we can get there until we have conversation what that means and what is being forgiven. I think for African Americans in America, one of the hardest things is the treatment. That's hard. And not being heard when I say, ouch. That's the dehumanizing piece. That's the absolutely dehumanizing. Right now, we're watching our country bring to the forefront issues that have been festering there for a long, long time. Try to talk about them again, and we still don't have a format, still don't have, I think, enough champions on the ground every day saying, ah, come on, let's talk about this. Come on, let's talk about this. We don't have enough yet to make that real difference. We have people who want to criticize this or say about that or do this way. We have people who want to manipulate the system to their own ends. But we need champions. Champions, people who stand up every day and say, this is wrong. Or let me help you with that. Or can we find another solution over here? Dr. King talks about love. So how about love as a way to get rid of bias? Ooh, that's a scary word. What does that mean? Oh my goodness, said it in public. Dr. King talks about agape love, which is neither romantic nor affection between friends, but is rather understanding, redeeming goodwill for all. Overflowing love, which is purely spontaneous, groundless, and creative. And this is, I think that's what is called for here. Creative solutions to our problems. If we keep doing the same old thing and keep getting the same old outcome, you know the definition of insanity. If you get involved, if you get active, if you begin to push the establishment and the entrenched ways in which we do things, there may come a day that you will join hands with others who are working to achieve the same goals. Remember that fear is hard to manage, but when the times get rough, don't let go. When someone says to you, black and white people can't ever really work together, hold hands, don't let go. When you look at the person across from you and he has six earrings and you don't have any, keep on holding on, don't let go. When you think that a demand from one of your colleagues is outrageous, hold hands, talk about it, don't let go. When you mess up and say something hurtful around a racial issue, apologize and don't let go. When you hear someone say something hurtful around race or gender or sexual orientation, point it out, accept their apology and don't. To build the beloved community of our collective dreams, we need courage. Don't let go. Honesty. Don't let go. Introspection. Don't let go. Laughter. Don't let go. More courage. Optimism. Empathy. Compassion. And we need one another. Don't let go. Please, if you have time, if you have resources, read The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. It's a story of the migration of black people out of the South. New York Times had it as, a few years ago, the best, one of the 10 best books of the year. Again, this is not, Dr. King was not just about black and white. He was about people, about us. And the whole idea of black and white, to grab hold of that, because it is such a volatile issue in the U.S., there's a place to start. If we can start reconciling that, there's a lot of other stuff that's going to fall in place. If I'm nonviolent, and I keep running into people who are violent, what do I do? You know? And I think each situation may be different, but I think the answer is I may not survive, I may not get to implement my whole nonviolent commitment right now. Maybe that happens in 50 years or 100 years. But I need to lay the foundation for that as a thought. I need to develop tools for reconciliation. If you get a chance to look at the tapes out of South Africa from the Truth and Reconciliation Committees, they're some of the most heart-wrenching things you'll ever see. But this is a part of what people go through to try to have peace. What has precipitated this militarization of our police forces across this country? The Pentagon is giving police forces equipment designed for war. What? But what happens when you hand somebody a weapon and you charge them with using it under your direction? And so what you're seeing in Ferguson was sort of an over, and what you're seeing throughout our country some days is that power has gone to people's heads. That sense of power, the guns, the I am the law and I am right, and if you, you know, either do what I say or die. Right now. That's scary. Okay. I was born colored. That's what it says on my original birth certificate. My parents were colored. Then we were Negro. That was with a small N. Then, hallelujah, we got a large N. We moved into being black, which was radical, because before that time, one didn't call other black people black. Then we moved from there, from black, into being African-American. And, you know, by the time you're my age, maybe we'll be Americans of African descent. There are 1,000 stories. You can choose to believe whatever you want. If you believe that we are equal, all of them are possible. If you believe that sub-Saharan Africa, everybody is stupid and dumb down there, nothing is possible. If you take a look at the world and you look around the Mediterranean Sea, you'll see how close those people were. They traded with each other. Cleopatra was not white. I heard she was fat black and 40 when she met Mark Antony. Now that's the rumor that I heard. The point being, any of that can be real. Why do we use it? How do we use it is the question. Rather than explore possibilities, we often bludgeon each other over the head with it. No, we were here first. No, we thought of this first. Who cares? Sometimes if you listen to people talk, you would think that African Americans never hurt each other in Africa. Go look at Africa. None of us is immune to murder, rape, denigration. Any of the things we do to one another, any group has that potential. The question is, what do we do to restrict, control, breed out, I don't know what you do with it, that potential? Can we learn enough not to be so reactive, so retaliatory in our approach to living on the planet? Well, we don't live like we used to live. I mean, we don't live in community like we used to live. And in America, every 5 years or so, families, many, many, many families move. They relocate. What does that do to the sense of community? And how do you build community given that reality? Because I don't think that's a conversation we've had. But it's a conversation. It doesn't seem to say to me that it's impossible. It just says to me, maybe we need to think of new ways to think about the idea of community and how we stay connected and how we stay caring. Because more and more of what's happening in America is we're living in communities of people who think like we do. Spend our time there, we do have our discussions there. When I grew up, we had to take civics. And a part of what you did in civics was learn the value of debate and discussion. And that was because you didn't expect everybody to agree with you, but you needed some skills and being able to persuade them. And so now, without those skills and without that impetus from civics class, which Oregon doesn't teach anymore, we've come to the place, well, if you don't agree with it, shut it off, close the door, don't talk to it, or kill it. I think one of the things I would say is we choose not to connect. Think about choosing not to connect. We choose not to say hello. We choose not to go certain places. We choose not to hear certain things. Not always true, but in the main, if we haven't been put someplace, perhaps it's harder to connect. Where is the guidance for people who want to not maintain the democracy, but to grow the idea of it, to transform where we are? Where is that leadership? Where is that guidance coming from? And this is a little bit back to Obama. I don't agree with all of Obama's stuff. I hate the drone stuff. There's other things I haven't agreed with. But there's something about his presentation of self that calls for us being more humane. That part I like. When I watch what has happened since he has been the president, and I say to some of my friends, you know, you don't have to use the word nigger to call somebody a nigger. And half the country's missing it. They're not seeing it. So what do we do as champions for the right to help them see it? How do we enter that conversation? Who do we need to talk to? This is one of the most manifest examples of racism right here before our eyes. And it's not even being talked about. It's not happening. It's not happening. No, no. It's because of his policies. No. You don't start off the day he's elected saying, our job is to get him out of office. You were talking about difference of opinion. Charles Jordan was a commissioner, the black city commissioner, when I came to Portland. And he and I disagreed on many things, and we were often in meetings together. And I would just say, well, Charles, you know what I think about that. And he'd say, yeah, I do. And we both laughed. And after the meeting and after the issues were discussed and however it came out, we were still friends. I think you do that in smaller communities. I think you have to. I think when it gets really, really big, you have options to go and be somewhere else and not pay attention and not care what somebody else thinks. But I think that's a really dangerous for us collectively. You know, you have to want to be a part of it. And I guess a part of what I've thought always is I want all I can get from where I live. When I lived in St. Louis in the 60s, South St. Louis was not a safe place for any black person to be. I would get in my car early on Sunday mornings and drive to South St. Louis early in the morning because I wanted to see what it looked like. It was my city and I got to go there. And it would be foolish for me to go over there, you know, in the middle of the day. But it was quite all right for me to discover Tower Grove Park and the nice little gazebo in the middle and understand that that's where the band played and to know what it looked like on the south side of St. Louis. It's my country. It's my planet. I get to be here. And I get to argue with people who don't want me here without killing them.
You've been listening to equal rights activist Kathleen Sadat on The Human Beat. Join us again at the same time next month.